I'm John Travis, and I have an opportunity to be with Jane Feigenbaum, CEO of Metropolitan Contracting. Jane, welcome.
Thank you, John.
I've had an opportunity to know Jane for 20-some years almost here, working in and around San Antonio on many projects. Excited. Thank you. And I guess my first question, for those that don't know you as well, what is your current role? What do you do at Metropolitan?
So as the Chief Executive Officer of Metropolitan, I am responsible for the financial well-being and the overall direction of the company.
Metropolitan has been around for 35 years?
Metropolitan was founded in 1986, and we currently have about 65 to 70 employees. And do just about every type of commercial work in the private sector that you can think of, excepting multifamily.
So private sector, no schools, public, government. In the time that I've known y'all, we've done everything from retail spaces to tilt walls to finish out to fancy restaurants to hotels. So all scope of private work?
Except for residential and multifamily, all scope of private work. We're what we consider to be a mid-size contractor. We build mid-rise buildings and renovations and finish outs. And if we've done that type of work, then Travis Paint and Travis Millwork probably have done it with us.
And a regional office both in San Antonio and in Austin.
Based in San Antonio, originated in San Antonio, and we opened an Austin office in May of 2021, and it is going gangbusters.
And 60-some employees, mm-hmm. Depending on the year, I know COVID and the like was in there, but $100 million more or less in work processed each year.
Yes.
Wonderful outfit from our experience. So, Chief Executive Officer of Metropolitan Contracting, how did you get there? How did it all start?
A little bit at a time. I really came into the construction industry sideways. I started with Metropolitan, it's been almost 28 years ago, as an assistant project manager. And I just had an affinity for it, and I really liked it. I liked the fast pace. I liked that my role was in the center of everything. I had worked for a manufacturing company before that sold construction materials, but I rarely ever got out to a job site, and I felt very far removed from the action. And so I just grew and grew in the project management role, and I became chief operating officer, and since 2018 I've been CEO.
Growing up, did you always know construction? Did you always like to build things, or?
None of the above. I got out of college with a Bachelor of Arts degree and really had no plan. My first jobs out of college, every interview I went to, they wanted to know how fast I typed and could I answer a certain type of phone system. And that just really, really ticked me off. And I fell into a job with a Domino's Pizza franchise that was growing very quickly. And I was on the new store opening team. And it involved, part of my role was working with the construction teams, and I just thought they were a lot of fun. Everything moved quickly, problems to be solved, everything from permitting to certificate of occupancy and everything in between, and I just liked it, and so I just continued down that path.
Did you always know growing up that you liked fast-paced problem solving, or is that something that came to you?
That's a great question, and it's something that came to me.
What was your degree?
Well, I would say I was an underachiever in high school, and I went on to my state university. I didn't really think a whole lot about it, and I kind of fell into a I tried business as a major, and I really didn't like it. And so I ended up being a political science sociology major. I got out of school and had waited tables, and so I knew I didn't want to be a restaurant manager. And I'd worked retail, and so I knew I didn't want to go into retail. And before I got too far down the road with process of elimination career decisions, I managed to find a job in construction that just I just felt motivated. I just loved being able to go in and help put out fires and solve problems. It was just fun.
So you got into construction, lit your passion, lit mm-hmm. your fire.
Yep.
And still doing it 30-some years
yep.
almost later.
Yes, correct.
How'd you get started at Metropolitan? So they hired you in as an assistant PM mm-hmm. 20-some years ago. Mm-hmm. What's the progression like for somebody from an assistant PM all the way up to the position that you have now?
So one, you know, obviously, or maybe not obviously, Metropolitan was a much smaller company at the time.
Sure.
I was willing to take on more and more, and I was young enough to not be afraid of things as I might should have been. And so I just said, sure, I'll do it. And I just kept doing bigger and bigger projects. And I think, you know, what I really learned very quickly, even in spite of the fact that I was one of the only women in a project management position at that time, the only one at Metropolitan and probably one of very few in San Antonio, was the subcontractors really didn't care whether or not I had all the answers. If I managed my jobs that they could get in and get out and make money, and I got them the answers quickly, that was all they were, and I treated them fairly, that was all they were looking for. And on the flip side with the client, you know, as long as I convey to them a sense of urgency about their project so that they felt like, I don't have to worry about this because Jane's worrying about it. That's what they were looking for. And, you know, as I got more experience and I did more and more complex projects, I gained the experience and, you know, made less mistakes.
What is a day you wake up in the morning? What is a day like now?
A day like now is not typically as full of fire fighting as it is when you're working, you know, project specific, but it is still, you know, you're managing people. And that's the other thing I've learned is that, you know, people laugh, and I do too, that I don't have a degree in construction management or construction science. But the truth is what I do is about managing people and about managing a business and about making business and people decisions. So I've realized that some of the jobs I had early on have held me in the greatest stead. Like, for instance, one of my very early jobs that I spectacularly failed at was as a headhunter, as a personnel recruiter. I was too young to do it. I didn't really understand how to match up a client and a candidate. But I use that every single day. I use the salesmanship, I use the closing, I use the people management, I use the recruiting skills, I use the interviewing skills. I use that every single day. So you just don't know.
And this, I totally agree. It seems like, and I'm comparing notes now, it seems like the majority of my job on any given day at this moment is recruiting the right people.
Mm-hmm.
And then motivating them and setting the expectations so that we all work together in a common cause as a team. At the same token, you're matching up to a client yourself or mm-hmm. somebody that works for you or somebody
yep.
Like you of, this is what you're going to see happen. This is how we're going to do it. This is what you can expect. Just most of the day is exactly as you're describing,
yep.
you know, that skill set over and over mm-hmm. and over and over again. And I think we can only do that repeatedly if we really enjoy building stuff. And you talk about problem solving, and you talk about the different passions that's there. I like to build stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just whether it's a team, whether it's a group of people, you know, whether it's a job, whether it's a building, whether it's an element, I get a kick out of seeing nothing, and then there's something. And sounds like you have a very similar drive and passion, and that's taken you so far over 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, I like putting, you know, I like putting pieces of a puzzle together. Whether it's financial or it's construction, if there's a financial, if something's out of whack financially, I like diving into it and trying to figure out where that trail is. Same thing with a job problem. It's I like analyzing a problem. I like understanding the crux of the problem. And then I like figuring out what the pieces and parts are on how to solve it and who I need to pull in to help me solve that problem. Because I might not be able to solve it myself. A lot of times I can't. I need to figure out who are the right people, what are the right questions to ask, where am I trying to go to solve this problem?
I think so I agree. I think a lot of people have trouble setting that priority, though. I mean, and I think that's part of what sets you apart and being very good at that is you can say, here's my problem, here's what I got, mm-hmm. here's my resources, here's my path through, here's how I need to set up the dominoes to fall. And I do find, and with young people, we have to kind of train and ferret it out. And sometimes not everybody can do it. Not everybody can walk into an issue, a problem, a room and say, here's the stuff, here's the order, here's what we need to do. Even if I'm not part of it, this person.
Some of it is inherent, I think. I mean, some people get it, some people don't get it.
Sure.
Some of it comes with the confidence of experience and
sure.
of years.
Yeah.
But I also think, and I remember that when I was much younger and less experienced, I did go to my supervisor and ask them, even if I knew the answer, it made me feel more comfortable. They might not even give me the answer. When I walked in their office and I asked the question and I heard myself ask the question, sometimes I came up with it on my very own and I would just say, oh, well, thank you very much, and I would walk out of their office. But I liked being able to bounce it against someone, and I feel much less like that's
security.
I don't feel that need. And yeah. I think that just comes with years.
So in your day-to-day, in terms of what a day looks like, a lot of it now is people or solving macro problems. Do you have an opportunity now as a portion of your day for somebody to walk into your office and be able
always,
to?
Always. Yeah. Always. My door is open most of the time. And I think people feel very comfortable stopping by my office to chat about something or ask a question.
Run something by you.
Run something by me. Absolutely. Yeah, I really, as a company, we are a very flat organization, and we do have a very real open door policy. The idea that an employee would feel uncomfortable, and I'm sure it's true just because of the position, but the idea that I intimidate somebody, it's hard for me to understand. It's just me.
I understand. But, you know, we're also encouraging our people to come in and not get, I call it, stuck.
Yeah.
Don't get stuck.
Right.
So come with a solution.
Yep.
You've mentioned that before.
Yep.
Come with your ideas. And hopefully 80% of the time the answer is, that's a great idea. Go.
Yep.
You
yep.
got it. Agree. But sometimes we do have to say, well, you might think about this.
Think about this. Or
yeah.
I would recommend, you know, I say that a lot. I would recommend, or, you know, I might look at it this way. And, you know, sometimes too, it's very helpful. And I know this worked for me, is to hear what my mentors, how they would attack a problem. You know, it was a great learning curve. And I think most people, you know, I've had supervisors from the time I started working at 15. I've had supervisors that I saw how they handled things and I thought, oh, that's the exact wrong way to do it.
But you learned.
But
yeah.
you learned yeah. what the exact wrong way was. And I've had other supervisors that I've thought, okay, this is a great lesson in how to handle something like this.
Have you been blessed, as I'm sure you have been, with great mentors along the way, people
yeah.
to help?
Yes. I mean, I for the most part, I've always gotten along well with my supervisors. Again, even when I was working, you know, at the Gap at the age of 16, and then certainly at Metropolitan, you know, watching how the two founders, Tim Swan and Steve Schutze, how they treat customers, how they treat employees, how they handle themselves, have been all of the right ways that I hope I have modeled myself on. You know, the construction industry for many years was sort of this old school slam your fist on the table when there's a problem, you know, public humiliation, you know, all of those things. And they were never, ever like that. They were always extremely professional. They always looked at the long game in terms of how you treat a client. You don't burn a bridge. You never know where you're going to deal with this person again. You look at the long game. I mean, we used to have a building that I would joke around that we warrantied it in perpetuity because it was so far out of warranty and it didn't matter.
Relationship versus transactional.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And both those gentlemen, very wonderful examples of
yes.
that. And to your point, not everybody is.
That's right.
Especially in the contracting world. How do you deal with the stress?
Well, I have three dogs that I kick. No.
No.
I do have three dogs, but I don't kick them. You know, how do I deal with the stress? Part of it is that my personality is one that sort of thrives on a little bit of stress. I have to be stressed to a certain level to perform. If I don't have enough to do, I slow down too much. But, you know, I mean, I just have tried to, I don't know how I deal with the stress. I think I've just tried to learn to take it in perspective, and it's hard sometimes. I mean, especially, you know, the younger that I was, and if there was a mistake or I didn't foresee something, I would lose sleep at night over it, and I would, you know, gosh, if I was just smarter, if I was just better, if I had just done this, if I had just done that, you know, it was hard. I think it's just age and experience that has allowed me to relax a little bit and you know, realize that, you know, as important as all of this is, and we're keeping families fed and we're doing all these things, we're really not saving lives. We're building buildings.
That's true. And it'll be here tomorrow.
It'll
be here tomorrow. It may rain tomorrow, so maybe the day after that.
That's right.
But it'll be here tomorrow.
That's right.
So as you work with, you know, you talked earlier about how traditionally it was a slam your fist, and you mentioned as a female in this industry in construction, what has that been like? You know, you talked about, and I think that's probably true, not especially metropolitan, but even in the industry in the 90s, especially, as I was starting out, I mean, I'm actually trying to think. I know of three.
Yeah.
You were one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now could be, you know, half. What was that like? Essentially, you were a trailblazer, even though you didn't realize it. What was that like?
You know, I'll go back to that for the most part, I realized that neither clients nor subcontractors really cared if you got the job, as long as you got the job done. That kind of went away in their head. You know, John Travis, the painting company owner, what he wants is to be able to get his people in and out of that job and make money on it. And if you find that you're running well-managed jobs, unless you're really a jerk, if you find that you're running well-managed jobs, you don't care. It's a good business
proposition. Get us in, get us out. Help solve our deal. Get out
right.
of our way.
Right. I would say if anything, you know, truthfully, I probably gravitated towards the finish out and renovation side of the business more because I think that, you know, the concrete and site work contractors are sort of the last of the, you know, traditional kind of construction cowboys, you know. So I felt less uncomfortable. I felt more comfortable in the other aspect of it. I think I probably was underestimated sometimes, which actually can really work in your favor because if you walk in and you're being underestimated and all you have to do is show that you're a little bit smart and a little bit knowledgeable and you pleasantly surprise everybody, then that's, you know, that's kind of easy. You know, so I think I also have always had the ability to not think about that. I don't think about, oh my gosh, I'm a woman and I'm in a meeting with eight men. I don't even think
just
about
you.
It. I don't, that's right. It's just me and eight people.
I think one of the things I've appreciated most in my dealings with you is the follow-up and the help in getting answers. I think one of the earliest ones that I did with you, which was probably mid-2000s, I'm assuming, was when I was starting the millwork business. It was a deal that had stained MDF, looked like a train tunnel that was down at like Bank of America building or that the building across the street. It's one of those for is the elevator lobby, and it was the most interesting, weird, but unique looking deal. I was down there a few years ago and realized they'd torn it all out and we'd spent forever. But it was all this multi-stained MDF. You may not even remember it.
I don't remember
but
that.
You went to great lengths to try and get these colors and different things approved so that we could do this job. And that's helpful on our end because you talked about getting in and out. You know, you're stuck. We're just in limbo. We're just burning dollars. You know, the gas, the engine's on and you're not going anywhere. So getting the information so that all we got to do is operate makes our job so much easier.
Well, that's good. And that's the part about it I like. I like figuring all that out and putting it all together and getting it solved and getting the answer. And you wrap it up and you hand it off to everybody and then you move forward. And I like that part.
So you deal with, you know, 1,000 probably subcontractors and vendors. You've got 60-some employees in your team internally. You have clients and architects and customers. What types of things do you value in those people that you're working with? What do you value in your team, for example?
I'll tell you, in my team, I value people that have a strong work ethic, that have a strong sense of integrity and a moral compass. And I would say I probably value those same things in a client and in a subcontractor. My personal hot button, just for the world around me, is fair. People should be treated fairly. The golden rule, if you just follow the golden rule, it all falls into place. If I treat subcontractors like I want clients to treat us, then everybody is happy.
And if
subcontractors treat us like I hope I treat clients, then it all works out. So I think a sense of fair play, you know, if something's your fault, you own it, you try to collaborate. The most fun projects are the ones where you're really working as a team, where everybody is working as a team together. Then the whole process is fun.
If not, it's just brutal.
If not, it is just brutal.
And the older I get as well, you know what it looks like when they go well. And so when they don't go well, it just sucks your will to live to some degree because you're like, here we go.
It's going to be a slog and you're dealing with people who might be, you know, not treating you respectfully, which is just, you know, that's nobody wants to get up and go to work every day and hate it. I mean, that's miserable. It's miserable.
What are your biggest challenges you face as a leader or metropolitans facing now? What do you see as you look out on the horizon at the moment? What are the struggles?
I think the struggles right now are finding and being able to hire good people.
Labor.
Yeah, labor is a big issue. You know, we at Metropolitan, we don't have, we have our superintendents and we have a couple of handfuls of carpenters, but we don't self-perform a whole lot of work. So, you know, it's so obviously a problem for subcontractors to find labor and skilled labor. I mean, and everybody walks around the job sites now with a phone in their hand. So everybody's one-handed. I'm surprised there aren't more accidents on job sites because everybody's walking around with their phone in their hand. So I think skilled labor, I think having good training programs, I think that, you know, the construction industry is really struggling on that end. It's hard to build things if you don't have people that you can give the job, the task to, who are capable of it.
I think labor is my number one as well by far.
Yeah. And you know, what training programs are there? And how do you afford to be competitive on projects if you're having to train people It's very, I mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, these are the challenges. These challenges are, we talk about. You know, I may not be, we may not be the cheapest at the moment, but, you know, we have these training programs that we're trying to create internally, both on the paint side and on the millwork side. We have, you know, more burden in order to do that. We have
technology
people that help
expenses.
Us, technology and podcasts and IT developers and, you know, keeping up with, you know, where things are headed and the speed of things.
Yes. I'm going to bet that we will, in 2022, we're going to spend 50% more on technology than, and when I say technology, I'm not talking tools, I'm talking office technology, computers, software programs, all of those things, you know, Surface Pros, all of mobile phones, et cetera. We'll probably spend 50% more this year than we spent 4 years ago. I mean, it just ratchets
up
every single year.
And then you have social media aspects. You have
these
other platforms that you've got to figure out.
Oh, yeah. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
You know, I would say the labor, far and away, number one. I would say at the moment for us, secondarily concerns are the technology, really tools that help us keep up with the speed and demands of closer collaboration that is done from afar, if that even makes sense. It just seems like the constraints on your time. Before, if you and I wanted to talk, we'd go hop in a car, we'd have to go to the meeting, there'd be five people there. Now somebody can have a meeting with 20 people, which is difficult in person, much less on Zoom or something like that. And somehow we've got to have this meeting on Zoom, and I'm calling the meeting in 3 hours. And so you're the speed of things is just getting crunched.
It is, and I'll tell you, personally, I'm not a big fan of virtual meetings. I don't think they work as well as people being in a room. I think in some aspects they can be more efficient because you don't have people kind of standing around and talking. But in terms of collaboration,
very difficult.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. I'm a great believer of working in the same space together.
30-some years in this industry, and here we're alluding to some of them, but what's changed? How is it different?
Technology certainly is one of them. I think the level of documentation that is required now is much greater. I mean, and it was already changing and requiring more documentation when I got into it, you know, 30 years ago, but even more so now. I think that the sophistication of the materials that are used has just gotten greater and greater and greater. You know, things like, you know, all of the changes in the glues that are done now and the issues that there may be that go along with that. And, non-VOC paint. I mean, there's just a sophistication level of materials that is just much greater. And you combine that with tradespeople who aren't as skilled as they were 30, 40, 50 years ago, and it's tougher to manage. It's just tougher to manage.
With all of some of the challenges that we've talked about, where do you see Metropolitan in your role as chief executive? Where's Metropolitan a year from now, or 3 years, or 5 years? And I'm not saying necessarily numbers, but just in terms of what's the feeling?
I think we greatly value our culture. And I think that maintaining that culture is very important to us. And when I say the word culture, what I mean is the open door policy. I think we have a very professional appearance. Our processes are very good and very strong. I always say that we take what we do very seriously, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. It needs to continue to be fun. This business is so difficult and can be so stressful and problematic that if you don't have a group of people you work with that you can have fun with and feel comfortable with and feel collaborative with, it just makes it
Miserable.
And so I think maintaining our culture while we continue to grow is really important. You know, we have now Fernando Diego and Taylor Jordan own a substantial portion of the company. They are managing partners. The three of us really on a day-to-day basis make all the decisions for the company, and they really run the operations. So I think continuing that growth and continuing to provide opportunity for ambitious people who want a career path at Metropolitan is really important. That was one of the big reasons why we opened up Austin. It just made sense, and it just gave us another market and more opportunity. But I would tell you that I will, you know, at a certain size, your culture just changes. There's nothing you can do about it. With that quantitative increase comes a qualitative change. And it's important to me to maintain the culture.
When you wake up every morning, what are you most worried about?
When I wake up every morning, I am most worried about making sure that we are providing a good workplace for our employees, and we are providing our clients with what we have committed to provide them.
I try and divvy things up by like macro problems. Yeah. And, you know, it's totally a great way to say it. You know, how do I solve my customer's problem? Mm-hmm. That's what you're suggesting. How do I provide a warm, you know, pseudo-familial environment mm-hmm. for our people?
With security.
Which means you got to build it bulletproof enough to survive the downturn or
right.
interest rates going up to 9%, which will have to affect us in some way.
Yes.
You know, so I worry about those things. And, mm-hmm. and like you mentioned, being able to provide a path for people.
Mm-hmm.
So those issues, and another thing I'm just curious that I worry about a lot is just, you know, you talked about how the documentation's bigger and, you know, time pressures and things get crunched. How do we make it simple, right? When really it's not simple. You know, we're dealing with people that don't have 30 years experience. They may have 6 months and a college degree that maybe is related to construction science, maybe not. My opinion is all that does, like you mentioned, is give us a baseline
yeah.
to then go build our experiences upon. But how do we create something to where it's simple for people to operate in with those policies, procedures, way of doing things? How do we boil it down? And I use a lot less words. I worry a lot about that.
Well, I do too. I think because processes, you don't want to become a bureaucracy.
Right.
But you have to have a certain
how do we get that balancing act?
Well, I think you have to think about it a lot. I think I am I hate forms that aren't used. I hate forms for the sake of having forms, because what ends up happening is people just check boxes
sure.
or they stop paying attention to it. But there are certain processes that I think keep you safe. And I think you have to really – the only way that people do things is if either they buy into why they're doing them or they're afraid not to do them. My goal is that they buy into –
They see the usefulness.
They understand how it helps to keep the company safe. And some of it is just, you know, making sure that some of it is delegation. Some of it also with these young people who are not as experienced, you know, you've got to set up a team of managers who are experienced, who are responsible for, you know, three or four of those people. So that they have someone that they can go to.
And go in the door and
ask
run it
questions
by them.
Of. Absolutely.
I somebody mean, to shadow.
Somebody to shadow, somebody who can say, okay, you're gonna run this project now. Here are the things you need to make sure you're looking out for. We're gonna meet once a week. I'm gonna go to the owners' meetings with you just so that I can hear what's going on. If you have any issues, you can come to me about them. You know, we have always preached that we can solve a lot of problems if we're made aware that there's a problem. But if somebody tries to hide a problem and all of a sudden there's a freight train 8 feet away from us.
Not a lot of options.
Not a lot of options at that time. So we try, really hard. And the only way that that works, though, is if people feel safe coming to you with their mistakes or their problems.
That's true.
If they feel like they're going to get penalized or punished or humiliated or any of those things, you know,
people stay silent.
People stay silent. And so you've got to set up an atmosphere where people feel safe coming to you. Now, obviously, it's not okay to make the same mistake over and over again. You got to learn from them, but people have to be able to feel safe coming to you and saying, listen, I screwed up. I need to let you know what's going on. You might get a phone call.
Then at least you're forewarned.
Far prefer that. Yeah. Yes. Takes the wind right out of my sails.
Yeah. The mantra is fess up first, fast, and often.
I like that. Yes, I like that.
Yeah, to your point.
Yeah.
We can't do anything about it. There's nothing worse than getting blindsided by a call at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Friday. And you had no idea it's coming, and our people knew about it for 4 hours,
Or longer, or all of a sudden realizing on a job cost that you're way over because somebody's been sandbagging a problem instead of coming to you right away and saying, I got a problem.
Well, very appreciative of your organization that you've helped contribute and are helping mold. It's been wonderful to work with on our end. A lot of lessons to learn from your wisdom and how you've put it together and your people and how they're doing it. I think it's great how your organization has evolved from a little old first building. I guess you've been growing and growing and growing since we first met. I got two closing thoughts here. First is there anything to a prospective client or contractor or vendor or architect or your group, is there anything that they ought to know about you or Metropolitan that we haven't talked about? Something that...
I think we have talked about a lot of it. I'll reiterate. I think in a business relationship, especially one that is as fraught with, issues as building anything is, there's a myriad of problems and issues on all sides. And so I think a sense of fair play and collaboration is just essential to a successful project. I think that in terms of us, it's our job to be credible. If we say we're going to do something, we need to do it. And if we screw something up, we need to own it. I think those are very important things, and I think those things mean a lot to us. Those are not just words. I think that we think about that. Our reputation matters to us, and we recognize that we live in a glass house. We certainly make mistakes, and we recognize that other people do as well, and pointing fingers doesn't help a whole lot.
Just solve it.
I
think that's very important, too, because in my experience in building a building, and I'm just several pieces of the myriad of pieces that you have to put together to build it, there is always something that doesn't go according to plan, starting from an idea to a piece of paper, a plan, but it doesn't matter whether dealing with the government in terms of permits or inspections to a design or a material vendor, trying to gather all these different pieces together to create something is a very up and down, in and out process. And it doesn't go exactly the way that you think it's going to go. And yet we all make it happen. And I think for people that come in with the expectation that 5 o'clock is always 5 o'clock and nothing will ever go wrong. My experience doesn't happen that
different
way.
Different business.
Yeah, right? It's not FedEx. You're guaranteed by 10.
That's right. You need to go into a different business.
True. So working through that, understanding that, and having that mentality, I think is very helpful. Served y'all well. Very appreciative of the business that we've been able to do together. I got a last question. So if you could go back in time, right? Or... forget going back in time.
Go forward in time.
Right? Forward in time to the next Jane Feigenbaum that shows up for her first day of work. What words of wisdom, encouragement, what would you tell that person?
Work hard. Return phone calls and emails in a timely manner. Not because I didn't, but just because that's what I would recommend to anybody. Stay ahead of problems. Treat people fairly. And give credit where credit is due.
That's wonderful.
Jane, and I want to just, wait, John, I want to tell you how much we appreciate our relationship with you.
Well,
so
thank you.
The appreciation is mutual. It really is.
It's collaborative.
There you go.
We go build some more buildings in the times that we have left. So thank you very much for taking the time. This
My
has
pleasure.
Been wonderful. Hopefully get to do it again. And Jane Feigenbaum, thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you would like to listen to more episodes, please check out our archives at traviscompanies.com/podcasts. We release a new episode each week. Next week on the podcast, we're going to be talking about our painting division and the different capabilities and abilities that we have within that division. We hope you'll tune in, and thanks for listening.